You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Good morning, friend. Welcome into the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, January 10th. A decade of days into the new year. My pleasure to be with you. I'm going to treat like this like the confessional, right? Sports confessional this morning. Something I'm ashamed to admit. I'm not expecting you to grant me absolution, but I am willing to do penance. And the thing I would like to confess, just between you and me, right? Seal of confession, all that. I went to bed at halftime of the Alabama-Clemson game last night. I was watching that game, 14-0 Alabama, then 14-7. I knew Clemson was getting the ball back second half, but to me, it appeared obvious. Alabama was going to dominate. Nick Saban, you know, the emperor, was going to win another national championship. The Death Star was going to do its work. And so I was so pleasantly surprised to turn on my computer this morning and discover that Dabo Swinney and the Clemson Tigers had won the national championship. And we'll talk about this a little bit more in our second segment, our sports segment, when those of you who hate sports can tune into something else. But I'm very, very happy for the Clemson Tigers for a number of reasons. I mean, it's always good to see somebody else win, right? I mean, it's nice to see that. Clemson has not won a national championship since 1982, I believe it was, so 35 years. And I have a lot of good friends in the state of South Carolina from when my wife and I lived in Myrtle Beach. I've even been to Clemson, been to a game there, touched the fabled Rock of Frank Howard there at Death Valley. Beautiful place. So congratulations to the Clemson Tigers. But that's not all we're going to talk about today, in case you were wondering. At the bottom of the hour, a guest we were planning to have on this past Friday, but had some technical difficulties, should be on over from across the pond in jolly old England, and that is Tim Stanley, who is an author, an historian, a journalist, a Catholic convert. But I noticed after he, I think on January 1st, actually, he tweeted out after seeing the film version of Silence. And if you've listened to this program lately at all, you know I've talked about the book Silence, the novel by the Japanese Catholic writer Shisaku Endo, which was, I think, published 50 years ago, which tells the story of some Jesuit Portuguese missionary priests coming into Japan secretly in order to minister to the Christian peasants there in the time of great Christian persecution and purging. That detail is true. The book itself is historical fiction. They also went to investigate and ascertain whether the rumors that they had heard that their spiritual father, their mentor, their priest friend, Father Ferreira, had apostatized from the faith under the threat of torture. It's a compelling book, and Martin Scorsese, I guess, read it back in the 80s, and the acclaimed director has wanted to make the film version of it ever since. And by all accounts, it is a powerful movie about faith and doubt and all the rest. And Tim Stanley saw it. I saw where he tweeted out, "The sobs that you hear from the back row of the movie theater are mine." So I want to ask him, what was it that made him sob? And I know one of the things that moved him about the film was the very positive, action-oriented portrayal of the priesthood. So look forward to talking to him about that at the bottom of the hour, assuming all goes well. I've been kind of on a bad guest streak lately. Technical difficulties Friday. Alan Alday's throwing up child yesterday. We'll see if we can start a new end a streak, just like Clemson ended Alabama's last night. Anyway, I'll tell you that story in the second segment. I'm married into a... Well, my father-in-law, huge Alabama fan. I found out how huge early in my wife and I's dating relationship. So I'll explain that a little bit later in the show. Also, what sorrow can and can't do. Objective truth and subjective guilt, something we got into a little bit yesterday. I want to talk a little bit more about the blessing of brotherly love. And as I said, a look back at Alabama Clemson. If you want to call up with a comment or a question, if you want to bemoan the results of last night's game or celebrate it, maybe give us a little rendition of Hold the Tiger. Sorry, couldn't resist. Anyway, give me a shout, 573-4BREAD-4. You can call or text. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com, or you can post a thought on Facebook or on Twitter. The readings for today, yeah, by the way, something else good happened besides Clemson winning last night. And by the way, make sure you say Clemson the right way, because there really is a hidden P in there between the M and the S. Please don't say Clemson. Clempson. I know there's no P in the word, but pretend that there is. Anyway, but not only the other good thing is I was here recording my weekend show that I do with Lavinia Spirito, my good friend and someone who's forgotten more about the scriptures than I'll ever know. We have a show called Unpacking the Gospel. Lavinia, one of the teaching leaders, founders really of Catholic Way Bible Study. Anyway, we met together to record our weekend show, Unpacking the Gospel, which if you've not heard that before, I invite you to go on to breadboxmedia.com, look for podcasts. You can listen through iTunes, Google Play, or Podbean and find some of the old episodes. We take the Sunday gospel reading, and we sort of unpack it a little bit as much as we can in a 30-minute show. But I was recording with her yesterday in our little upstairs recording studio here at Breadbox and kind of pulled open the little keyboard drawer, and there was my Bible. My little Bible that I had been missing for weeks now. I get kind of attached. This one is a little faux leather-bound small version of the Revised Standard Translation of the Scripture. It's a Catholic edition. I just like it. It's about the size, maybe a little bit bigger than the size of my hand. Smaller print, yes, but so convenient, and I'd been missing that, so turn back up. Like I said, I get a little attached to my Bible. That's one of the things I tell our students in my New Testament class, or I told them the same thing in the Old Testament class. Yes, you can have the Bible digitally, right? I mean, they all have their devices, they carry their laptops and all the rest. You can have your digital Bible, but you really need to have one you can carry. Maybe it's just me. I'm old school that way. I prefer feeling newspaper between my fingers or a book in my hand as opposed to a Kindle or whatever. So anyway, good to have my Bible back. Anyway, today's readings, first from the letter to the Hebrews, which is a beautiful letter that really helps you understand. It's been often commented, this is the book of the Bible that establishes the traditional reality and truth that only men should make coffee. Hebrews, sorry. Anyway, you'll use that later, I'm sure. The first reading from Hebrews chapter 2, a book that really helps us see more clearly how Jesus is the consummation and the fulfillment of all those who had come before him, the one to whom all the prophets pointed, the one who is the fullness of revelation as opposed to those partial revelations of God and his purpose and his nature who had come before. And Hebrews chapter 2, establishing in more detail who this Jesus is. For it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are speaking. It has been testified somewhere. What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You did make him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. By the way, if you ever want to find the daily readings, just go to usccb.org and put your cursor over Bible, and it'll come up today's reading. You'll see it. Well, that quote there in Hebrews, and Hebrews has a lot of actually quotes from the Hebrew scriptures from the Old Testament. That's from Psalm 8, which is my favorite Psalm, which says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You've made him a little while lower than the angels. You crowned him with glory and honor. It's a fascinating how that text is used here in the letter of Hebrews, because, you know, usually when we read Psalm 8, when you it speaks of all humanity. But when you see it here in this context, the writer of Hebrew is attributing this psalm to the quintessential man. There's this great Jesus himself. There's this great line from the Second Vatican Council. Pope St. John Paul II loved it. Christ fully reveals man to himself. Christ fully reveals man to himself. In other words, we want to know what God had in mind when he created us as human beings. Then we look at the face of Jesus. This is what God had in mind. Jesus, yes, fully God, but fully man. And so no wonder the writer to Hebrews talks about this one, Jesus, being made a little lower than the angels. You know what's interesting about that phrase there in the Hebrew? That word angels is actually the word Elohim, heavenly beings. It's actually the word used for God. You have made him for a little while, or you have made him a little lower than God. Well, Jesus himself, of course, is God, but in his human nature, and we in our human nature, we are infinitely, of course, different than who God is. Yet we have a profound, immeasurable dignity. And we'll talk about this a little bit more in the second hour. Dignity enough that we can call Jesus, and he calls us, brother. We'll be back with more in just a minute, including our question of the day. This is the Mike Allen Show. You're listening to Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Minutes past the hour, you are back on the Mike Allen Show. You want to learn more about Breadbox Media? Check us out at breadboxmedia.com. See explanations, helpful videos on what we're about. You can also listen to podcasts of all of our different contributors or support your favorite show, wink, wink, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, by becoming a friend of that show. Check it all out at breadboxmedia.com. My question of the day is, do you oppose or support right-to-work laws? From what I understand, and this is not my wheelhouse by any means, but right-to-work laws are laws in which businesses, corporations that have organized labor or organized unions in some places, basically to work at that place, you have to be a member of that union. It's a required thing. What they call it, a closed shop or whatever. So you have to pay union dues, unions which represent the workers, which advocate for more just wages and so forth. But there has been, of course, a feeling and a concern among some that unions have acquired too much power, that they have become corrupt, perhaps. And there are workers who would like to work for a company but don't want to pay for the union dues. And so I think probably most famously, the state of Wisconsin with Scott Walker went through this. Well, the state of Kentucky, where we broadcast from, which is now, I think, for the first time in the state's history, has a Republican governor, Republican House, and Republican Senate, much like the federal government. And so I think they passed a right-to-work law here in the state of Kentucky, which means workers have the right to work someplace without joining the union. Well, our local bishop, Bishop John Stowe, who's been a guest on the program before, who's the bishop of the Diocese of Lexington, really in keeping with a pretty common stance of Catholic bishops throughout the world, is on record, in fact, wrote an open letter to the representatives there in Frankfurt opposing this right to work law. The Catholic Church, really since the time of Pope Leo XIII and his encyclical Rerum Novarum, have been strong advocates for the rights of workers to organize. Anyway, this is what Bishop Stowe had to say. The dignity of work and the rights of workers are critical to our approach to economic issues and laws. Workers cannot be treated merely as a means for corporate profit and production, but must be seen as autonomous human beings who contribute to the common good through their work. Modern Catholic social teaching began in 1897 with Pope Leo XIII's encyclical Rerum Novarum, which emphasizes the dignity and rights of workers, and in particular affirms the rights of workers to organize for the protection of their just rights. Among those rights are the right to decent wages and safe working conditions. In Catholic teaching, unions are described as an indispensable element of social life. Unions are to promote solidarity among workers. They are essential for economic justice and to protect the rights of workers. Of course, he goes on to say, it follows from the strong support of organized labor for the common good that unions need the support of the workers they represent. When all workers benefit from the negotiations of the labor unions through better wages and conditions, it is only just that the workers should participate by paying dues to the union which represents them in the workplace. Of course, he also talks about how places that have implemented right-to-work laws, which have in many ways undermined the unions, have seen a negative result in terms of wages and benefits. So what's your thought on that? 573-4BREAD-4, 573-4BREAD-4. You support or oppose right-to-work laws and why? 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. As I said, big game last night, of course. I went to bed at halftime of that game. Alabama was up 1 point in the first half, 14-0. Then Clemson cut it to 14-7. I knew they were getting the ball back to start the second half, but I'll be honest with you. I did not have a lot of confidence in the ability of Clemson to come back in that game. And from what I understand, watching the highlights this morning, it was kind of that way through most of the third quarter as well. Alabama up 17-7, sort of controlling the game. That front, that fearsome front group for Alabama on defense. Wow, tough. But evidently, they got tired. So Deshaun Watson was able in the second half to come back and bring Clemson all the way back with Bam. I've got to see. Surely this is going to be like an instant classic or whatever they call it on ESPN, where they replay it again, because I've got to see that second half because it sounds like it was just compelling. And then, of course, Deshaun Watson completing that pass with 2 seconds to go, 6 seconds to go when the play started, completing that touchdown pass to Renfro with a second or two left. Man, something to see. And Crimson Tide fans, it's tough. They take their football quite seriously. They take all their sports quite seriously, which I found out when I was dating my wife. My wife, who's originally from Alabama, her father, a huge Alabama fan. I didn't know quite how huge until we had been dating less than a year. And, here I was, didn't know any better. I was 19 years old, and Kentucky was playing Alabama in basketball. And Alabama had a pretty good team that year. Kentucky also had a really good team that year, as they do most years. Anyway, Kentucky was playing Alabama basketball, and my wife's father, Jim, and I had been sort of bantering back and forth leading up to the game. I thought all in good fun. I got 2 tickets to the game. I took, who's now my wife, I took his daughter, Angie, to the game. Kentucky blew Alabama out. When we got back to their house, I opened the front door singing the UK fight song. I threw open the door and I went, on, U of K. That's when I discovered just how passionate a fan that he was, because he proceeded to tear me up one side and down the other. So I learned to tread a little bit more softly in UK Alabama games. So I'm sure he's a little heartbroken. But he's pretty, I think he's reached a point in his life. He's 85. He's a little bit more philosophical about it. My goodness, they've won 4 national titles in the last 8 or 9 years. Somebody else has to win every once in a while. But speaking of Clemson, as I said, not only do I have a lot of friends who are Clemson fans, and so I'm very, very happy for them. I've always been a little bit partial to Clemson and always go with Clemson in the Palmetto State-Clemson-South Carolina rivalry. But I also have another memory of Clemson's last national championship team, which was the 1981 season. I think they won the title in January of 82. The reason I remember them is because I was a junior in high school, and it was high school band day at Kentucky's football stadium one day that fall. It happened to be the day that Kentucky football was playing against Clemson, this very same Clemson team that would win the national championship that year. And so, you know, I had my little saxophone, my band uniform, getting ready to walk onto the field at halftime with lots of other high school bands and this band extravaganza. And we just happened to be stationed right where the Clemson players ran off the field at halftime. Now, believe it or not, Kentucky was ahead in that game at the half, 3-0. They would lose, I think, 21-3. Sick that I remember that. But here I stand, and I remember, I'll never forget, running right past me went the behemoth of a freshman, William the Refrigerator Perry. Now, it's interesting because Perry, if he played today, would just be average size, if not even a little early. But as a 300-pound guy then, that was humongous. So I have that little memory. Of course, Homer Jordan would lead that team to national championship. Now, 35 years later, they've got another one. Hold that Tiger! Congratulations to Clemson. Let's sneak in our What Were You Thinking nominees for the day, because we've got a few spanning the globe. By the way, if Clemson had lost last night, one of the things that I would say on a What Were You Thinking is I never understand why when you have fourth down and a half a yard, you put your quarterback in the shotgun. I've never understood it. Why cede 5 yards to the defense before you even start the play? But that messed up for Clemson last night early on, but they ended up winning, so we'll drop that. Anyway, our first nominee, Go Dumb or Go Home. Man barricades himself in house after family members take bite of his grilled cheese sandwich. A Maryland man has been arrested following an hours-long standoff with law enforcement that police say began when a family member took a bite from his grilled cheese sandwich. I think we're about a minute early there, Alex, on the music. There we go. Anyway, let's see. Baltimore police spokeswoman said the man was eating with his wife and daughter, became angry when one took a bite from his sandwich. Look, I understand we get defensive about our food, but really? Second nominee, woman bitten by crocodile attempting to take selfie with it. I'd say that story kind of speaks for itself. This was in Thailand. Hey, honey, here, take my picture. Wait, you mean these things bite? But the winner we're going to give to Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep, of course, gave an impassioned speech, very critical of our president-elect. And, I'm not saying that there weren't some significant points about the Donald. I've made them myself. But when she says here at the end of that speech, Hollywood is crawling with outsiders and foreigners, and if we kick them all out, you'll have nothing to watch but football and mixed martial arts, which are not the arts. Ms. Streep, did you watch Deshaun Watson last night? That man is an artist. We'll be back with Tim Stanley. Talk about the sobs of silence. This is The Mike Allen Show.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're right at the bottom of the hour, back on the Mike Allen Show here on this Tuesday, the 10th of January. Continuing, I guess, you know, when you're in a bad streak, it just continues in terms of guests. Still trying to effort Tim Stanley, the British journalist and historian who we had originally hoped to have on the show Friday. We had some technical difficulties in making the Skype call, and we talked about him coming on the show this morning to talk about his experience seeing the Scorsese film Silence, which I'm just hoping against hope that's going to come out here soon in Central Kentucky. So we were going to talk about that. So I messaged him last night, check in and see if we were still on, and I have not heard back. So there may be another issue. So just bear with me. I promise when we finally get Tim Stanley on the program, we will let you know. 573-4BREAD-4 if you want to chime in. 573-4BREAD-4. You can email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com. Again, my question of the day, do you support or oppose right-to-work laws? You know, typically, predictably, I would say, if you're a Republican, you support right-to-work laws. If you are a Democrat, you oppose right-to-work laws. Because what you see... We got him on there. Oh, Tim, hello.
Sorry about that.
Oh, yeah, no problem at all. Good.
I'm here. Hello.
Hello. How are you doing? Happy New Year.
I'm very well. Happy New Year. Happy New Year to all.
I'm glad we worked this out after our technical difficulties last Friday. So thanks for making time.
Very sorry about that.
Oh, no problem at all. The problem may well have been on our end. I wanted to talk a little bit about, you know, I've been looking so forward to seeing the Martin Scorsese film Silence. I asked for Christmas for the book. I'd not read the novel. I decided I want to read the novel before I see the movie. And so we got the novel, and it's just, I read it in about 2 days. It's compelling. It's been haunting me ever since. Still haven't seen the film, but I saw you had tweeted going to the film, and great tweet. You said, "The sobs you hear coming from the back row are mine." So... Let's talk about the film a little bit. Try not to give too many spoilers away. But what was it that you found so gripping?
I haven't read the book. I've only seen the film, and everyone I have spoken to has taken away something very different from it. What I felt was that this was a frank, painfully honest exploration of faith. It's important to bear in mind that it's about a very, very specific moment in time. I think it's the 17th century. It's Japan, during the period in which Christianity in Japan has been driven underground. And two priests travel to Japan to try to find a third priest who is rumored to have apostatized. And when they arrive in the middle of the most terrible persecution. And it's not giving the plot away, because this isn't the most important part of the plot, to say that they are caught and they are posed the choice of apostatizing or Japanese people will die. And that's the central moral tension. Now, it's very moving, partly because that's such a dreadful thing to have to face and the agonies that they go through of trying to resolve that question are both physical and emotional. But it's also very moving because the film is an uncompromising representation of Catholic belief. And there are people in this film who are martyred for their faith without any doubt about their faith. There are people who serve their faith, as the Jesuits do, with this incredibly bold, masculine, honest and enthusiastic way. It's just simply the most exciting and, as I say, uncompromising representation of Catholicism that I've seen on screen ever, I think, ever.
Let's back up just a minute and talk about the persecution itself. You know, certainly the 16th century and 17th century, not difficult persecutions, lots of places, including in your own native country. There were horrible persecutions, but usually we think of persecutions in terms of the situation of facing suffering yourself or denying the faith. Yeah, I think what made this different was this, you know, here's someone who is a spiritual father, a priest, a shepherd of souls. They can audibly see and hear the suffering of Christian peasants All he has to do is step on the fumier, the image, and deny the faith. And what's been surprising to me, Tim, is the sort of I've been surprised at the vigorous debate that I see happening among people of whether or not we can all say we don't know what we would do in those circumstances, mm-hmm. right? But I've actually seen people argue that you should trample on the image in that yes. circumstance. And boy, it's easy to say, I know, from the sort of safety of my speculative seat, but wow, I mean, it's hard for me to go there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I had an argument with a friend about the film. I urged him to go and see it, and he said it's a dreadful film. The film supports apostasy. The film is about giving in and giving up. And it was only about halfway through the conversation with my friend that I worked out he hadn't seen the film.
Wow.
And I got really angry with him because I said, you are telling me what I've just seen on the cinema screen. it is a very specific moral dilemma that they are posed. They are not being asked to give up their own faith and to avoid their own in order to avoid their own martyrdom.
Right.
They're being asked to apostatize or other people will die. And some of those people who might die are people who themselves have apostatized. So they would be allowing people who don't even believe in Christ
right.
to die for Christ. So it's an incredibly complicated and specific thing. And it's not even clear, again, I don't want to go into it and give anything away, but it's not even clear that anyone does actually apostatize. I don't think you can judge what you would do in that situation. And to me, in a way, although that is the moral crux of the film, for me, the bigger portrayal of faith and the complexities of faith and the way it constantly forces us to ask ourselves why we're doing what we're doing and are we doing the right thing, the overall emotional experience of sitting through that and exploring that, to me, is actually more important than this rather narrow debate about whether or not they did the right thing. But certainly, I've been astonished by the number of people who told me with great certainty that they would never apostatize. And I hope it's true. I hope it's true. But I would never dare to say that about myself. And yes. I don't think most people who actually have been martyrs would have done either.
Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Who knows? And only by the grace of God. There are those who are calling this the most powerful Catholic film ever made. Would you concur with that?
Certainly in terms of films that I have seen, in terms of taste, I've always found the biblical epics of the 1950s with Charlton Heston and Choirs of Angels, I've always found them a little bit dry and uninvolving. I think for those who see faith as a complicated journey and full of stumbles and obstacles, I think this is perhaps the most involving film. Mm. It was very interesting in the cinema. A few people walked out. I think that's interesting. So here's a film which is capable of driving people away, and that means it's doing its job in some ways. Some people were clearly confused. Some people laughed in the wrong places. That might sound odd, but some people actually laughed in some places, I think because they found some of the faith on display a bit hysterical and ridiculous. But a lot of other people were crying along with me. I mean, I wept on three separate occasions. Mm. It was good enough. You know, my eyes dried and then it all started again. In terms of sheer power, and how extraordinary that a man who is not the most orthodox Catholic, perhaps not the most committed Catholic, although I don't know much about Scorsese personally, but it's not someone who has dedicated his life to the church. He works within Hollywood. He's produced films which are crass and violent and some of them quite unpleasant. How extraordinary that this man makes the film that the Catholic Church should have made years ago.
Well, it's not to stereotype, but if it's a movie that can make Brits cry, then we know it's got to be powerful.
Oh, yes, that means it's good, yes.
So one of the things you said on Twitter was, you know, that you had, it was the most, and you hinted at this already, that such a compelling vision of the priesthood. I mean, you said yourself, you know, you've been... there have been those who've tried to plant seeds of vocations in your own mind and so forth. But this, for you, was the most compelling vision of what the priesthood is.
Absolutely, because it was full of the phrase, the urgency of the Gospels. It was full of the sense of something that you have to do, that is a compulsion. Rather than vocation, sometimes in Western societies, is explored in a very roundabout way. It's a little like would you like to take up yoga? And it can be a little self-centered as well. Whereas the utter conviction of the Jesuit fathers, but more importantly, the thirst, the hunger of the people who they went to serve is striking. And when they first arrive in the Japanese villages, the villagers throw themselves at their feet and demand that they hear their confessions. They desperately want to confess. They desperately want the sacraments. But also the Japanese peasants, obviously being left alone for a long time, have gotten a couple of points of doctrine wrong. So there's an important role of the priest when it comes to teaching as well. And most of all, it might sound strange to keep on coming back to this, but the masculinity of the priesthood is something that really comes across in the film. Mm. There are almost no female characters in it, except for one very important one at the end, which I won't give away. But women are not really present. And very often the church nowadays has become the mother church in more than just a metaphorical sense.
Hey, Tim, can you hold on through the break here for just a couple
absolutely.
Minutes?
Absolutely.
Okay, fantastic.
Yes.
We'll be back in just a minute with Tim Stanley, British author, historian, journalist. We're going to talk a little bit more about the film Silence. This is The Mike Allen Show. We'll be back in just a minute here on Breadbox Media.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Fifteen minutes before the hour, you're back on The Mike Allen Show. Here on this Tuesday, the 10th of January, pleased to be joined from England, Tim Stanley. Tim, who is an historian, a journalist, an author, and appears on CNN, writes for the London Daily Telegraph. We're talking about the film Silence, which he saw actually on New Year's Day, tweeted about it, and having read the book and talked about it a lot on the show, I thought it'd be great to talk about it with him a little bit more. We were talking a little off air, Tim, about the Japanese inquisitors and those who implemented this systematic purge of the Christian faith from Japan, which evidently initially the response to the missionary St. Francis Xavier and others, there was a veritable explosion of the faith in Japan, really resonated at some level. But then when it became apparent there was this sort of interweaving of maybe colonial imperialism and the faith, they saw it as a threat to their culture, and they began to seek to systematically get rid of it, which I guess if you're going to try to get rid of Christianity, you couldn't do much better than the approach the Japanese took.
Absolutely, which is to discredit it, not to try to wipe it out, because the phrase comes up again and again that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church, and it's absolutely true throughout the history of our faith. There have been attempts to impose Christianity on people, don't get me wrong, but it has advanced fastest and deepest when people have seen signs of the willingness of people to be like Christ and die for the faith. I think that's happening now, by the way. I think there is a revival going on in the West, and I think it's linked to people like Father Amel and to the massacres in Iraq. So the Japanese conclude, as the great realists they are, that it'd be much better to discredit the faith and to have the Jesuits admit that it's nonsense than to actually have anyone killed for it. So that's what they're trying to do. They're actually, in a perverse way, trying to avoid bloodshed. Killing people to force the Jesuits to recant is their way of avoiding bloodshed. There's a lot of class in the film as well. The Japanese are far more motivated by a hatred of the poor than they are necessarily the hatred of outsiders or of Christianity. But also that dynamic is one reason why you can watch this film as an atheist or a humanist or a secularist, whatever, and it'll have just as much of an impact, because it's about the necessity of conscience. It's about what happens when an individual refuses to give up believing something and they collide with the state, which tries to compel them to stop thinking that thing. And you can watch this film even without religious belief, and you can see that in the ultimate analysis, a Jesuit's life without Christianity would be not worth living. And to apostatize is worse than physical death, because you would be left living for the rest of your life knowing you have betrayed something you believe in very strongly. And I think that could apply to Marxism, that could apply to liberalism, or any human creed. And for that reason, I think the film could and should be watched by people who are without faith, as well as those who are believers.
Mm. One of the, I think, undercurrents, and this is, I'm speaking from the book, but I assume it's there in the movie as well, the whole line between missionary work and cultural imperialism, and how to bring the faith to a culture that doesn't know the faith without at the same time seeking to impose certain cultural expectations. What does Christianity look like in Japan as opposed to what it looks like in Europe?
This is a very interesting question, isn't it? And this is where the Vatican II debate comes in and becomes very complicated, because the attempt in the 1960s to acknowledge the diversity of the faith, I think, was very, very well intentioned, but ironically actually ended up becoming quite prescriptive, because it's my understanding that prior to Vatican II, there are many variants of rites. And if you look at art and culture from Catholic missions and Catholic countries prior to the 1960s, you do see a diversity in representations of Christ. It's always to a Westerner slightly amusing to see Korean depictions of a Korean Jesus Christ. But why not? Because certainly our European depiction of Jesus is deeply inaccurate. So there is that interesting question of how do you explain something to people, something which is really very alien, but speaks to a universal truth, but needs to be understood on their own terms. And the film does imply that it might be being misunderstood. On the other hand, when the Japanese encounter the Jesuits, it's very clear that they understand the basics. They understand the fundamentals of doctrine. They understand, I need to be christened, I need to be received into the church, I need to have my sins heard, and I need to receive the Eucharist. They understand the essentials, and that's because those are universal.
Mm. Yeah, one of the things, arguments that is made in trying to get them to apostatize, I think maybe even from Father Ferreira, who I think is played by Liam Neeson in the film, is that the so-called explosion of Christianity in Japan was really an illusion, that it was more syncretic, that they basically just kind of overlaid Christianity on top of their Shinto or Buddhist beliefs. And so, yes, that whole question of how deeply the gospel really penetrated.
But the question is unanswered as to whether or not Father Ferreira is lying.
Right.
He might be lying. That might be his, because to explain to those who haven't read the book or seen the film, at that point he's trying to convince his fellow Jesuit to apostatize. So it's possible he's not telling the truth. It also should be said that God is universal to everyone. He's there even when the church isn't there yet. If there are elements in other faiths which speak to God, that is a reflection of the divine genius in everyone. It makes perfect sense to me personally that a Shintoist could hear elements of Christianity and see it reflected in his own religion, because his own religion is in part constructed upon the human conscience, and that itself is authored by God. And in culture after culture, you have a search for the divine, you have a sense of morality. So it's hardly a surprise that there are things awaiting Christianity which can make some connection with it. So I don't, but I can understand why that argument is very useful for the Japanese to say, look. But also, again, it's rooted in class. Essentially, the argument is these people are too stupid to understand Christianity. And actually, the evidence on screen is quite the opposite, that even without the priest there, they have maintained the traditions with a faithfulness which implies they understand them.
Well, you're only whetting my appetite to see the film, so hopefully it'll be available here in our little backwater area sometime soon. Let's shift gears. We've got about 4 minutes left or so. I want to ask you, of course, we're sitting 10 days away from the inauguration of President Trump, which are words I still can't believe I'm uttering out of my mouth. what are you expecting from the early months of a Trump presidency?
I'm expecting a bonfire of executive orders. I'm expecting 100 days of Donald Trump to announce things that he is no longer going to be doing. environmental regulations thrown out, everything that he's signed up to, limits on drilling, for instance, in the Atlantic. I think there's going to be a lot of activity like that. There's going to be a lot of rallies. There's going to be a lot of surprise announcements. I think there's going to be activity on building the wall. That's going to matter. Activity in terms of diplomacy with China and with Russia. I predict confidently that his first visit overseas will be to Great Britain. Although it's notable that the Prime Minister of Great Britain is already booked in to go and visit him. He might also visit Israel. I think it's going to be dynamic, and I think it's going to dominate the news. The really interesting question for me is, will he give up his Twitter account, or at least hand it over to him? Because he's going to have two. He'll have both the President of the United States, which presumably will be an entirely formal one, but he'll also retain his personal one. And I really do think it's become a problem. You cannot have the President of the United States having a cat fight with Meryl Streep over Twitter. You can't do it.
But, you know, here's the thing, Tim, okay, and I find it appalling, of course, but I think if you look at it in terms of purely politically and strategically, he wins those exchanges. I mean, Meryl Streep is not convincing anybody, I mean, that is for Trump, and it's sort of like, you know, if you get engaged with somebody who that is their preferred medium, then it's a disaster.
Yes. And one thing I do find refreshing about Trump, and that I'm getting used to and learning to live with, is that he exposes people's hypocrisy because he doesn't back down. Presidents in the past would either have ignored Meryl Streep or would have essentially said, "I'm sorry," and rolled over. I part of me does have to respect the fact that he replies with sheer vindictiveness. Because Meryl Streep personally may well be committed to helping disabled people and helping disabled people in her industry. But her industry is one of the most discriminatory and prejudiced industries in America. They don't have, there are no disabled people on screen. There was a study that found that 95% of the roles of disabled people on TV are played by able-bodied people. Is that not a form of blackface? That's deeply hypocritical. To attack Trump for misrepresenting disabled people and then to work in an industry which does that on a routine basis, I find that deeply hypocritical. And I do quite sneakily like the fact that something about Trump exposes other people's flaws.
It will be a wildly entertaining. I mean, his inaugural address, his first State of the Union, must see TV.
Absolutely. It's going to be great. He'll keep on telling us it's going great while he's doing it.
That's exciting.
This is a great inaugural. One of the best inaugurals I've ever seen.
Tim, always a pleasure. Thank you for taking time, and really appreciate your great work and your witness for the faith and everything
Thank
as
you.
Well. So blessings to you in the new year, and maybe we'll talk again down the road.
I hope so. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye. We'll be back in a minute with a new hour. If you want to chime in with a comment or a question, 573-4-BREAD-4, 573-4-BREAD-4. Email me, MikeAllenShow@gmail.com.
Listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.